Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News Now in Depth on how we choose to fall in love. It seems as if Mandy Lynn Catron began to get a grip on love just as she was losing it. In the wake of a slow-motion breakup with a longtime beau, she began to ponder why we love when we love and how we decide who to choose. She would take some hard-won wisdom and a provocative questionnaire into the next relationship, and you might remember what happened next. Mandy published an essay for the New York Times Modern Love column called "To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This." I read it, it went viral, and long story short, here she is today. So as Mandy joins me today, we'd love to hear from you. Is there a question, an imaginative, intriguing question you wish you'd asked, you did ask your beloved at the beginning, that would have told you so much more about them? What is that question? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Mandy Lynn Catron is a writer and a creative writing teacher at the University of British Columbia. The new book is titled How to Fall in Love with Anyone, and she joins us today from San Francisco. It's a little early there, Mandy. Welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Okay. I want to put that question that I'm asking our listeners to think about to you. Rewind the tape with Kevin. Is it fair to say your first big love, right?
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Is there a question early on that you could have asked him that might have been particularly revealing, that would have told you some things that even later in the relationship you would have been like, ah, you know, should have woken up on that, should have checked in on that?
Honestly, I really think I would have benefited much more from asking myself some questions at age 20.
Like what?
And even sort of throughout that relationship, I mean, one of the things that I realized in the process of writing the book and doing all the research that went into the book was that I spent just years, maybe most of my life, feeling like love was this thing that happened to me. And that I really just didn't have any say over the process. And the reality is that we have a lot more control over this experience than we think we do. And, you know, I wish I had just thought about what I wanted from a relationship. Like, what would I like a relationship to look like? And how would I like to be in a relationship? And these are things that I just, like, never considered when I was younger.
But I mean, but some of that is just maturity and experience. I was the exact same way. First big love, you know, summer between high school and going off to college. I didn't have any of the kind of self-awareness that you're saying you wish you'd had. I don't know that any of us have it at that age. That's part of, I think that's part of that experience and the value of falling in love at that age.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think it's definitely really normal to not really know what you're getting into and to learn from experience. But at the same time, like, one of the things that motivated me to write about romantic love was this sense that there was a difference between how we talked about love and how we actually practice it.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I realized is in so many of our love stories, and in just in our language and the metaphors we use, we really position love as something that happens to us and that we have to be really, really passive in the process. And I do think it's possible to change that, to think about love differently, even when you are 19, 20 years old.
I think you're right about that. I mean, think about even saying falling in love. It suggests that you've reached this precipice and you have no choice but to tumble, or I was swept away. I didn't really have any, right? I didn't have any control. I didn't have any agency in succumbing to that experience. So what's your argument? That we have more control, we have more influence on ourselves than we think we do?
I think so, yeah. I mean, ultimately, romantic love is a biological experience. There's tons of research that suggests that it's something that happens in our brains and in our bodies. There is a sort of neurochemical process that seems to be fairly predictable. But I think despite the fact that, you know, we don't necessarily have control over like the dopamine levels in our own brains, we do have a lot of choice about who we spend our time with, who the kinds of people we want to invest in, and what our relationships ultimately look like. And these are things that, honestly, when I was younger, it just never occurred to me that that was possible.
I've often thought about the timing, and I think there's really something to, for many people, timing, right? Like you've come out of two or three relationships that just, you knew they weren't going to be long term. I'm just talking in general here. I mean, this is my own experience too. And you're kind of primed, right, in your life. Maybe you've gotten your career a little bit on track. You're a little more mature. And then I feel like timing just means you take a second look at somebody in a way that maybe you wouldn't have if you'd met them a year earlier or a year later. What do you think of that theory?
Yeah, I think that's totally true. I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge, as much as I like to say we do have a lot of choice, that love has a lot to do with luck and chance and what's happening in your life at a particular moment in time. And I think it's, you know, I wrote about this a little bit in the book, like the man that I did the 36 questions, the sort of infamous study with, he and I met years earlier. And I remember seeing him on OkCupid and I blocked him because he was a student in a continuing studies class that I was teaching. And I couldn't bear the thought of a student reading my online dating profile.
And so
I just blocked him and I thought, oh my God, I hope he doesn't see me on here. And then, you know, a few years later, I felt totally differently.
Right. Because of a different place that you were in your life and the experiences. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the experiences that were now embedded in your life that maybe opened you up to a different way of thinking about this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at that point, I had done several years of research about romantic love and just digging into the psychology and sociology and biology and really thinking about what it could be. And I think I had a much more open mind at that point in my life.
I think Teresa hears what we're saying here on Twitter. She says, I knew I was falling in love when I realized I couldn't start dating my now husband until I got my head on straight. No butterflies, just oh. Now she's practicing exactly what you've said here, that we have more control over the way we're going to think about a serious relationship than we think we do. I mean, she said to herself, I need to get myself together before I start with this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting and great. I love hearing stories like this.
I think what you wrote about how online dating has made the challenge of meeting someone a lot easier, but it's made the challenge of how to choose much more complicated. So why? I mean, there's an endless number of choices. So why has it made choosing more difficult?
Yeah, online dating is pretty interesting because in one way it's great. Suddenly we have this huge pool of potential partners, which I think makes it more likely potentially that we could find someone who's a good fit for us and mm-hmm. who really is worth investing in. And yet at the same time, I think so often those interactions are very superficial and it's difficult to really deeply connect with someone. It's not like when you meet someone through mutual friends or through like your softball team or through your church or any of the ways that people have met other people for years, where you sort of slowly get to know someone over time. It's just this, you have this one meeting. Often I think it feels like a bit of a job interview. You ask a lot of logistical questions and then you kind of decide, like, do I want to see this person again or not? And I think often it's this paradox of choice where we feel like because there is this huge supply of partners, we don't want to settle too quickly. And often I think that means we don't go on second dates with people who could actually make great partners if we got to know them over time.
I mean, in some ways, this feeds the online dating. While it opens up a whole world of choice, as we've said, it also feeds that thing about instant gratification, right? So you might be 30 minutes into your online date and sparks aren't flying. And you have, you know, in the back of your mind, back to Tinder, where I've got a million choices, or back to OkCupid, where, you know, I've got six people who already have said they, you know, they want to connect with me. I think it reinforces this idea of instant gratification. What do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think so often, again, if you look at the language, we have this idea that we're supposed to be like struck by love, that it's supposed to sort of come out of the blue and it's going to be this really overwhelming feeling and we're going to feel it right away. And, you know, if you just talk to people, you know, like your friends, your family, I'm sure tons of people would say, yeah, you know, I met my partner at like X situation and for a long time, like, I didn't really pay any attention to them. Or we were just friends for 3 years and then suddenly we started a romantic relationship. Like, I think there's so many instances where it doesn't happen that way. But our stories of romantic love really glamorize this like intense, you know, magnetic feeling. And we we go into online dating expecting to have that exact thing. And otherwise we think, oh, well, there was no spark. I'm over it. I'm moving on to the next person.
I think this could be fun. You're making me want to ask our listeners this morning about, you know, is the person they're with their beloved, somebody who at the beginning they thought, meh, and, you know, and they didn't think it was going to go anywhere, because this would be fun to hear these stories. So why don't we do that? Mandy Lynn Catron is with us this morning. If you've just tuned into the show, she's the author of How to Fall in Love with Anyone. We've gotten into this part of the conversation where we're kind of talking about how we choose to fall in love. And I think it would be fun for us to hear from you about whether, you know, you were friends with this person, or, you know, you didn't think too much of it. You saw him at work. You went on a couple dates. Meh, nothing special. And somehow you've ended up with them. How did that happen? Talk to me about it. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, and online and on Twitter at Carrie MPR. Mandy, tell us a little bit about, so I mentioned Kevin, and he's somebody that you met in college. Was it before college? No, in college, right?
In college.
In college, yeah. Okay. What was that first meeting like?
So the first time we really got together and spent time, I guess I should. So the first time I met him was, I was on the college newspaper staff and he was the staff photographer.
Right.
And I went to a staff meeting and we all had to introduce each other or introduce ourselves to each other. And I just thought, he's so cute. You know, it was one of those feelings where I was instantly smitten. And then he went away. He went to study abroad. And when he came back, he had this long hair, he had a beard, he had been in Europe, and I just thought, oh my God, like, what do I need to do to figure out how to talk to this guy? And so I think it was one of those situations where there was this real kind of power imbalance. Like, I just wanted his attention. And I think so many of us often feel that way when we meet someone.
Yeah.
Especially when we're young, maybe. And while it was so gratifying to finally get his attention, I do think it kind of put me in this position where I was pretty vulnerable and I wasn't really willing to articulate what I wanted or even ask, like, myself what I wanted.
Right.
Because all I really wanted was his attention.
There's a part in that story where, and I'm trying to remember if this is, he's been away and he's coming back, where you constantly play over in your head what it's going to be like when he appears in your doorway and he's kind of slouched in his way. I love that. I could relate to that so much. You know, that's part of the fun and the anticipation and the, I think, lovely suffering of being in love at that point in your life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I mean, there was definitely a lot of suffering in my early 20s. We had a sort of long distance relationship that was very ambiguous for several years. He went away and joined the Peace Corps. Right. I went to study abroad in England. And there was this constant question of, like, what is his role in my life? And while that was exciting in many ways, I also think it really was one of those experiences that so many of us have when we're young, where I really sort of fetishized romantic love. Like, it seemed to me the most profound experience I had ever had. And while I think romantic love can be profound in many ways, one of the things that I've come to learn in the process of writing about it over the years is that it's also really ordinary.
Mm. A call here from Jenny in Rochester. Hi, Jenny. What's the experience of your meeting?
Good morning. I wanted to tell a little story about how I met my husband. I had just gotten off of a big breakup, and it was my brother's wedding. And he was a friend of my brother's, and he just kept asking me, cutting in on every dance at the wedding. And I just didn't think he was that good looking because he had really long hair and a long beard. He had just come from Alaska fishing. And he was just so funny. I spent time with him decorating with the crew for the wedding, and I just thought, he is so funny. And so after the wedding, he called my brother and he asked for permission for my phone number and asked for permission to ask me on a date. And I love that old-fashionedness about him. And my brother called me and asked me, and I thought, I don't know. I thought he was kind of ugly, but he was so funny, and I need somebody to have fun with. And then we did. We went out on a date, and I got the surprise of the ugly duckling revealed. He shaved off all of his beard and his hair, and he was really handsome. And I was so happy that I did that, gave another chance.
You could have blown him off right away, Jenny, and never known what was underneath the hair.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. To Ben in Minneapolis. Hi, Ben. What's your dating experience been like?
Yeah, good morning.
Hi.
So I'm sort of the millennial generation, and so I've been very involved with all the dating apps and dating sites.
Mm-hmm.
And I've definitely noticed that it kind of turns people into addicts of a dating, a serial dating culture,
mm-hmm.
I think. I've noticed, you know, over years, seeing just a lot of the same people on a lot of those apps and sites. And in my own experience, the girl that I've now dated for about a year, I met her actually in a bar, but kind of, you know, like some people are saying, I didn't initially think it was going to ever be something serious.
Yeah.
But after spending more time and getting to know her, we've really made a connection.
Yeah. I was thinking, Mandy, thinking about what Jenny and Ben said, I mean, both of them, had they had a not so hot experience, you know, with an online date as they did with these first meetups, they might have never gone back, and there always would have been other pastures to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. Which I think just points to one of the many ways the sort of myths that we have about love in our culture shortchange us.
Right. Tiffany says, first date with my now husband, I didn't feel fireworks, but a genuine connection. And somehow we knew we would end up together. And then she adds, but it took me months to finally decide I really wanted to make a go of things with him. Okay, we've heard about Kevin and that relationship. Boy, it took you a long time to break up that relationship. How long in total were you with Kevin?
About 10 years. Yeah. So from age 20 to 30.
So I called this a slow motion breakup. I mean, how many years were you in the process of actually breaking it off with him?
I think honestly, and it was like a year and a half, maybe from when we started seriously
wow.
thinking about ending the relationship to when we really fully ended it.
Yeah. And then you were single for quite a while.
Yeah, for 3.5 years, probably.
Dating. But what were you learning about yourself?
I learned so much. I mean, one of the most important things that I learned was that being single was great. And I think for me, because I had been in this relationship for most of my adult life, I had just never been in a situation where, as an adult, my time was totally mine. I could do sort of whatever I wanted. The only creature that I was accountable to was my dog. Obviously, I had a job, and I had to walk the dog and feed the dog. But beyond that, it was kind of like I felt this incredible freedom, and it was just like little things. Like I could decide what to watch on TV, and I could decide what time to go to bed. And the breakup was incredibly difficult, because I think breakups often are. But there was this unexpected sense of freedom that came with that. And again, this is one of those myths about love, which is that life is always better in a committed, serious relationship than outside of one. And what I found is that dating was fun, which was new to me because I'd been in this relationship for so long, and that being alone was like really rewarding.
Call here from Annabelle in Eden Prairie. Hi, Annabelle.
Hi there. Pleasure to speak with you. I just wanted to let you know and the author know that I had read your article. Let me set the scene here. I was 17. He was my first high school boyfriend. I'd wrangled him into a Netflix and chill session. And 3 weeks later, we decided that we wanted to fall in love. So we went to a coffee shop in uptown Minneapolis, and we read through all of the questions, but still 3 months later there was a mess, and then a year later there was a messy breakup. So no matter how much you know about somebody, things can always change.
Okay, so Annabelle, you worked your way through the questionnaire. You felt like you left that experience knowing more about each other, but it ended up not being true love.
I think that the one question I would have asked would be, tell me about your parents.
Oh, yeah. What? Because that ended up being a deal in their relationship?
That was the thing, you know, when you're 17, it's often the thing.
I'm glad you called, Annabelle. Now we'll talk about the questionnaire, Mandy. So you end up meeting Mark, and you decide, remind me, how many months in that you're going to use Dr. Aaron's questionnaire?
Oh, we did it on our first date.
Oh my gosh, first date. I forgot about that. Okay.
Yeah, it was this situation where I wasn't even sure if it was a date. Like as far as I had seen on Facebook, I didn't know him well at all. We were just sort of acquaintances. And I'd seen on Facebook that he was seeing someone. And so I was kind of like, oh, you know, is this a date? Is it not? I was kind of dating someone at the time as well. And so I thought, oh, well, we'll just like see what happens. And we went to the art gallery. Then we went out for beers after. And as we were sitting there chatting, he said, I have this theory that you can fall in love with anyone. And because I wrote about romantic love and I had a blog about love stories, people would talk to me about love all the time. So I didn't really think much of it. And I was like, oh, I wonder if that's really true. And I remembered the study that I'd come across in my research a couple years earlier, and I told him about it. And because I thought he was kind of cute, I was like, oh, you know, I've always wanted to try it. And he was like, let's do it. And so we did.
We should talk about some of the questions that I pulled out. There's 36 questions in the questionnaire. And here's one of them that I think is interesting. And this goes to what Annabelle called to say. Number 10, if you could change anything about the way you were raised, what would it be? Mandy, what do you think that reveals?
You know, I think the content of the questions themselves is pretty interesting, but I'm not convinced that it would have to be these questions for it to work. Like, they could be different questions that are similar. Like, really, the point is kind of that the questions start out pretty casual. So the first one is like, if you could have dinner with anyone living or dead, who would it be? And then they get more personal as you go along. Like that one gets a bit more personal. And the idea is that I think the psychologists call it sustained escalating reciprocal personal self-disclosure. I think that's the term they use.
I called it, there's an interesting rhythm to these questions, but yeah, I see what you're saying. Right.
So the idea is that they get more personal as you go along and you kind of don't necessarily notice that that's happening.
Right.
And suddenly you realize like, oh, we're in really intimate territory. And they are the kinds of things that you would probably talk about with someone that you were close to over weeks or maybe even months. But the idea is to accelerate that intimacy into a couple of hours.
I don't know. You know, I'm looking. So I've got your book in front of me and I've opened it up to the questionnaire and I'm looking at set two of the questions, which start at number 13. And it occurs to me, I've been married for a long time. I don't even think my husband could answer some of these questions about, he wouldn't know what I would say to some of this.
Yeah.
I mean, this is,
yeah,
they're provocative. I mean, even number 13, if a crystal ball could tell you the truth about yourself, your life, the future of anything else, what would you want to know? That's complicated. It's deceptively complicated.
It is. And I think part of the fun of doing these questions is not just that you feel a sense of closeness with another person, but my experience was that I also learned a lot about myself in the process. Like,
yeah,
I surprised myself with some of my answers. And that was pretty cool. Mark and I were just looking these over the other day. And one of the things that we realized is that we don't remember our answers. We don't remember our own answers to many of the questions or each other's. And so,
that's funny.
You know, maybe at some point in the future, we'll try it again.
Mel says on Twitter, met my hubby in a cave covered in mud, decided I wanted to marry him. And we just celebrated our 12th anniversary plus 2 years of dating. To Riley in St. Paul. Hey, Riley. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah. What's your dating experience?
So my dating experience is a little bit unique, I have found. I was with a man for 7.5 years, and we were engaged for a year. And about 2 months ago, we broke up. And right now, since I'm really new to the dating scene, I have decided to not jump into serial monogamy, which is what I have done before.
Uh-huh.
And so I am experiencing the idea of dating more than one person at a time, and not just casually dating. The idea of seeing them and then being able to explore, and everybody's on the same plane, and kind of seeing where that goes, because I see some of the flaws that come with our dating scene, which is you meet someone, you maybe go to one or two dates, and then you immediately jump into monogamy, when yet there might be some more exploration you want to do out there.
Plus, you're learning, as Mandy has said, you're learning a lot about yourself, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have a group text with my friends that I keep them up to date on all my Bumble dating experiences, which have been very, very interesting.
Oh, I would like to read that group text. That sounds kind of fun.
Yeah.
So how long do you think you'll be good with this? For as long as it takes?
You know, it's a little bit as long as it takes. I have a weird sort of arbitrary number of I really want to be single or feel like I'm single for about a year before I jump into this. Because again, that was I'm 29, going to turn 30 this year. That was really my 20s that I was faithful and monogamous. And so really wanted to jump into something very, very different. And I'm really enjoying it so far, even with the ups and downs of the good and bad days.
Way to go. Mandy, what do you think of this plan?
Oh, I love it. I think it's great. I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is that the love stories that are really popular in our culture really sort of presuppose that there's a right way to be in love and a right way to practice love. And that's essentially what she was talking about here, which is like meeting someone, committing to them pretty quickly, getting married, buying property, having children. And so I think the reality is that there are lots of other ways to practice love. There are lots of other roles that love can have in our lives. And because this sort of dominant narrative is so powerful, we often forget that those other possibilities are out there and that they can be rewarding and meaningful, and that something short term or something casual or something less committed can also be like a really valuable experience for us.
You know, I was thinking when I read your chapters about how Hollywood influences the way we think about love. That could be its whole show in and of itself, but you're an interesting person, so I knew we'd miss out on that if we just did the show on Hollywood. But I think this is important to say that you write, I came of age in this era of unlikely lovers overcoming relatively surmountable obstacles. It seems to be our arguing that really influenced the way you thought the way love should play out.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and that was really sort of the era of the rom-com. Like, romantic comedies just aren't the sort of big box office tickets that they used to be. The popularity has really declined.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up with, you know, When Harry Met Sally and Pretty Woman and I don't know, Notting Hill. I mean, I could go on Dirty Dancing. And all of these stories have essentially the exact same plot. I mean, a couple of details are changed, but they all have the effect of really sort of fetishizing love as this experience where someone who is essentially sort of ordinary is chosen by someone interesting or powerful or important, and that really dramatically improves their life and guarantees that they'll be happy forever. And so once they commit to that relationship, the story ends. And I think that idea is so problematic. But for me, it was very seductive.
It is. It's the reason I wonder why I love the novel Jane Eyre so much. I reread it once a year. I love the novel, but it's exactly what you've just described. And it's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about Jane Eyre, like Mr. Rochester is really just sort of a horrible guy
in many ways. He's a creep.
I know. And we're like so satisfied when she ends up with him. And like at this point, he's sort of debilitated and she has to take care of him.
He's
and like
been a jerk too, all the way along. Right.
Yeah. And that is so messed up. But one of the things that I found in the research is that so many of our contemporary ideas about romantic love are really rooted in these Victorian ideas. And these, like Bronte novels and Jane Austen novels, like these were the sort of the first stories about this kind of romantic love. And they really captivated our culture. And like, we really haven't let go of that yet.
Let me grab a call here from Lindsay in Sioux Falls. Hey, Lindsay. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Doing good. What are you thinking about?
Well, my husband and I met in 2008. I had recently sworn off relationships, but he came with a friend to my birthday party, and I was actually interested in his friends. I had a crush on him, but we ended up talking, and we will both admit that there was no physical connection. There was no spark. But we sat in a bar and talked for about an hour and a half about the economy, about gas prices. And there was this intellectual connection where I realized that for one of the first times in my life, I was talking to someone who was smarter than I was, that I could learn from. And even though I was a single mother and he'd said he would never date a single mom again after a bad experience and I wasn't looking for a relationship, he would come over and we would talk. And our early dating wasn't your traditional because I was very committed to my role as a mother and I didn't have a lot of time for him. But through that intellectual connection, it really became clear that we could always find something to talk about and be friends forever. And our relationship from that point on moved very quickly. And we were married just over 2 years later.
Wow.
And now celebrating 7 years.
See, I trust it's going to be interesting to hear what Mandy says about this. I really trust that intellectual connection over the physical connection. Well, you need the physical connection, obviously, to make the relationship go on. But Mandy, what do you think of that?
I think it's super interesting. And again, I think it's goes back to this idea that there's supposed to be this instant sort of powerful physical response when we meet someone that we're attracted to. And then if we don't feel that way right away, then that will never develop. But obviously, there's so many interesting stories where people do develop the physical attraction after they develop a friendship or an intellectual connection. And so I think it's important to know, like, and that's, I think, the really interesting thing that I got out of doing the 36 questions is that there's something to be said for getting to know someone and trust them and really enjoying their company.
Yeah.
And then that can generate these other feelings.
So I wonder if you've read Danny Shapiro's new memoir, Hourglass. Have you had a chance?
Oh, I haven't, but it's on my reading list.
It's the best literary pairing with your book, which is kind of part memoir and part, I don't know what, sociological exploration. But there's a part, so I interviewed her about it, and there's a part of this conversation that has just stuck with me. She says in the memoir, you know, this is about a long marriage. They've been together 18 years and dated before that. And she's talking about how love gets shaped and reshaped in a long relationship. And she has this beautiful paragraph. She says, We are delicate. We are beautiful. We are not new. We must be handled with care. And what I thought about that was, you know, you usually think it's the fragility is at the beginning. We all have to be at our best selves. We have to be so careful. But I really like the idea that she is saying deep into this relationship, we recognize what this is going to mean to sustain it. And there's fragility in that. And we have to pay attention to that. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I really love that idea. It's really beautiful. And I think, you know, one of the things that inspired me to start doing all this research and write this book was my parents' divorce when I was 26. And they had been together for almost 30 years at that point. And I was really shocked that that anything was less than perfect in their marriage. And I think that was really the sort of inciting incident for me, because it made me think that my basic assumption about how sustaining a relationship worked, which was that you had to love your partner and just like be a good person, like you had to not cheat on them or not fall in love with someone else, that as long as you did that, that you would just be happy and right. that would be all you needed to do. And when they separated, I realized, wow, maybe I've gotten everything that I've believed about love wrong.
I don't know how you're going to feel about this, but we're going to close with music from The Titanic, one of those other movies that influences the way we think about love. Mandy, thank you so much. This was fun. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Mandy Lynn Catron's book is called How to Fall in Love with Anyone. You can read about it on The Thread.